Welcome to JCCT Pulse. This is a podcast that brings you an overview of the most recent issue of the Journal of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography and in-depth conversations with the article authors. In each episode, we will go over a few handpicked articles to keep you up to date with the latest in cardiovascular CT.
Welcome to a special episode of JCCT Pulse. Today we will be discussing the SCCT's guidance for use of cardiac computed tomography amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Our experts include Drs. Ron Blankstein, Andrew Choi, and Todd Vilines, with recommendations and experiences from Dr. Kelly Branch and Dr. Mahmoud Mossabasha of the University of Washington, as well as Dr. Gianluca Pontene of Centro Cardiologico Monzino in Milan, Italy.
I'm your host, Dr. Kavita Chinayan from Beaumont Health in Royal Oak, Michigan.
I'd like to invite Dr. Todd Vilines to JCCT Pulse, the editor-in-chief of JCCT. Todd, welcome to this special episode of JCCT Pulse, where we will be discussing the impact of COVID-19 on the performance of coronary CT angiography.
Hey, good morning, Kavita. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Can you tell us what you think the impact of this pandemic will be on cardiac computed tomography, and how this is going to impact imaging in general?
Well, I think we're all learning as we go. And I think, you know, one of the benefits to the field of cardiovascular CT that the Society of Cardiovascular CT brings is not only do they help promote best practices, promote science, promote education, but they also give guidance in all of those areas when there is uncertainty in the field. And so this pandemic has caused a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fear. And yet we know that many patients will be coming to our scanners. Some of them maybe need scanning, and perhaps there's smart ways where we can defer imaging appropriately. And so I think this document is extremely timely and very helpful in giving guidance in uncertain times. And that's what societies do. And so I think, you know, what I'm most excited about, and I want to give congratulations to Andrew Choi, who led this effort along with Ron Blankstein, who was the senior author and president and also led this. I want to give credit for just how not only timely this was, but how quickly they put together such a really impactful document.
Yes.
And I think we'll see, I encourage all of our listeners to go download this. It's open access on the Journal of Cardiovascular CT site. But I think what they'll see is that there are several things. Number one is that it prioritizes safety, not just for our patients, but for our technicians, for cardiovascular CT providers, for nurses, and everyone involved in the delivery of cardiovascular CT. It also gives some guidance on where we can defer elective procedures, and also reminds us that in patients who have suspected or already are positive for this novel coronavirus, that in most cases, we can defer cardiovascular imaging in probably the majority of those patients. And then lastly, something that's really, I think, of interest to me, who I do a lot of inpatient cardiovascular work, is that this unique role for CT, particularly in patients who are in the hospital, who maybe don't have COVID-19, but are undergoing procedures such as transesophageal echocardiography to rule out intracardiac thrombus. It reminds us that instead of doing a procedure like a TEE, where there's a lot of airborne risks and aerosolization, that CT is very quick and easy. And we have, in my practice here, started doing that as the default test. We've done it for a number of years prior to ablation and in select patients prior to cardioversion. But I think now we've really gone away from doing TEE in appropriately selected patients. So kudos to the group and to the SCCT.
Yeah. Do you feel like, you know, some of these changes in our practices in cardiovascular imaging that have come out of this pandemic will be beneficial over the long term, just because of how much we are learning about how to do things differently and perhaps more efficiently and appropriately?
I do. And I think there's a couple areas. I mentioned, you know, the one indication, which, you know, we know, I think CT is probably the gold standard for clearing the left atrial appendage. In fact, when we see something funny on a TEE, we often refer them to CT. And so if you can do that at a very low radiation dose, doing two scans with a combined dose of under a millisievert with low contrast, it's just a quick, efficient way, and you don't have to involve an anesthesiologist or a whole group of providers, and it's non-invasive. But I think also in the area of myocardial injury, you know, this rush to take people to the cath lab, I think COVID-19, we've realized that a lot of these patients don't have significant coronary disease. There's this concern for myocarditis, and maybe getting a CMR is not readily available. So doing a coronary CT, I think we'll see an expanding role in patients with myocardial injury, possible non-ST elevation MI. And we realize that many of those patients do not have obstructive coronary disease. And we can just do a CT quickly, rule that out, and probably better select patients for the cath lab even after this pandemic is over. I think you'll see a shift to that.
Yes, absolutely. And I encourage everybody to read this document. And Todd, thank you so much for being here and for your guidance and, you know, wisdom during these very turbulent, unprecedented times. And I hope that you and all of our listeners will be safe and take good care.
You too. Thanks, Kavita.
Thank you. I'm delighted to invite Dr. Ron Blankstein from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, also the president of SECT, as well as Dr. Andrew Choi from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., to this special episode of JCCT Pulse. And Ron and Andrew spearheaded the efforts on putting together a document on the use of cardiac CT during the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome, Ron and Andrew.
Thanks, Kavita, for having us.
Thanks, Kavita. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you both. And thank you so much for putting together this wonderful document. It's incredibly well done, very detailed, and very, very thoughtful. So, Andrew, can you just share with us what your thought process was on why such a document is needed?
Yeah, thank you, Kavita. And just a note on how excellent these podcasts have been for the listeners. And so thank you for putting these together. You know, my hospital is in downtown Washington, D.C. It's a few blocks from the White House, from the State Department, and a mile from Congress. And so we are always in a state of readiness for any kind of national crisis, including the one that we're currently in right now. And we're often involved in the care of these federal constituencies. And so we've been in a state of readiness and our leadership going back to January. And kind of with that in mind, and as somebody that's also been on the front line of clinical care, as we saw new recommendations coming from the CDC and from the government for deferring elective testing, it became very apparent that how to apply that guideline for the field of cardiovascular CT and for cardiovascular imaging was wholly undefined at a time that we've never seen before. And so it just triggered a need. And I reached out to Ron and the SECT leadership to ask, you know, how can the SECT look to really articulate the needs of this current crisis?
Yeah. And Ron, how do you think SECT as an international organization, you know, comes into play here in guiding the imaging community on what to do during this crisis?
Well, I think this is really an unprecedented situation here that's challenging not only, you know, folks in the U.S. like the three of us, but individuals all over the globe. And SECT is, as we all know, truly a global organization. We have members all over the world. And this is one of those unique situations where we really all need to get together and learn from each other. So particularly for this document, for example, we have Gianluca Pantone, who's in Milan, one of the epicenters in the world right now. And he's provided us a lot of useful insights from his center. In the U.S., Kelly Branch in Seattle at University of Washington also has a lot of insights from that part of the country where they're also battling COVID-19. I think one of our strengths has always been our diversity at SECT. in this case, global diversity, but also diversity as cardiologists and radiologists, where we are, you know, fighting different aspects of this very same disease. So when we put that together, our group of experts who put this document together really had complementary viewpoints, complementary insights into what recommendations we should be making at this time.
And I think one of the important things, the three of us are on Twitter, and Andrew, you have been really a stellar proponent of the use of social media in learning and understanding and disseminating information on cardiac imaging. And it seemed like, you know, when this pandemic began, we were gaining more information from random cases on social media. And did you feel like that was one of the things that kind of drove the need for a cohesive document, Andrew?
Kavita, that's a really good point to bring up. And we've seen how social media as a platform itself has really accelerated the transfer of knowledge. And really, for the last few months, social media and more recently webinars have been, I think, the only way to get insights and information from the medical community from some of these pandemic areas. And I think in an era in which we have, you know, these really unique multimedia approaches, we need to incorporate them to rapidly disseminate the information. But social media is limited because it's not peer reviewed, and it doesn't allow you necessarily to filter that information. And I think being able to have a society that is highly collaborative, the way that the SCCT is, to bring in the different viewpoints and to bring in the different expertise is what I think was needed so that we could lend some more, I think, important guidance towards approaching this pandemic.
Yeah.
Kavita, I would add that I personally have learned a lot about this from social media, especially given the fact that this is a pandemic that's sometimes changing by the hour. And many of us are trying to learn as much as possible, as rapidly as possible, through every possible medium. But with that also comes information overload. I think we're all getting a lot of emails from our organizations, from our hospitals. We're continuously seeing new material on social media. And someone like yourself, who's always reminded us at SCCT that we need to stay grounded and have mindfulness, I think a real challenge at this time is how do we handle this information overload in an efficient way, but also in a way that we know when to sometimes turn off the devices for a few hours and connect with others.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of, you know, tell me what you think, Aran, about the issue of, you know, the importance of canceling or really postponing elective cases and the importance of social distancing, which would give us more time, perhaps, to be mindful and be be grounded.
Yeah, I think it's a really important principle that unfortunately, I think, is not practiced uniformly at this stage, but we really have an obligation to cancel all elective cases. I think many of us know that many of the tests we do in imaging are not absolutely, you know, needed or, and certainly can be deferred. And the problem is that when you have healthy people come into the hospital for an elective test, what I'm telling a lot of my patients is that the risk of coming into the hospital and potentially being exposed to the coronavirus and developing COVID-19, the risk of that is in many cases far greater right now than the information or the benefit of the exam. So really, the vast majority, if not all, elective cases should be deferred or postponed at this point. And it's really a test that we think are absolutely needed, tests for patients who are unstable, or a test that we think will result in immediate change to patient care, and not just change to patient care, but in a way that actually will change patient outcomes. So, of course, this is challenging, and this is something that all imagers across the country for all modalities are facing. And these are, at times, easy decisions. For instance, it's a no-brainer that calcium scores should all be canceled right now. But at times, the decision, should we postpone this test or not, could be more challenging. And this is where communicating with the referring physicians, all three of us at times are both the referring physician or the imager, but having those discussions with the referring physicians to understand how urgent or not a test is essential right now.
I want to add, one of the really important tent posts that guide this document is really the protection of our technologists, our trainees, our staff, our physicians, you know, all of those individuals that are involved in the delivery of cardiovascular CT. And we have an obligation as medical professionals to prevent the transmission to our patients and to individuals in the community. And we also have an important obligation to really protect the people that we work with on a regular basis so that we limit that exposure and really find those patients that are going to truly benefit from a CT examination and to ensure that those patients can get their CT examination.
Yeah. I think that's a great point, Andrew, that this is, of course, it's for protecting the patients. It's also for protecting our staff and ourselves. And I would add yet another point that actually in my institution emerged this week is we started implementing a policy where all healthcare workers need to wear PPE on site. So if we are performing unnecessary tests, we're frankly consuming resources that we need elsewhere. So if we perform unnecessary tests, that means wasting PPE in some cases that we critically need on the inpatient service. Or using other resources, physicians, techs, their services perhaps are going to be needed in other parts of the hospital.
Yeah. You know, I think despite everything that we are rapidly learning about the pandemic, the message, I feel, isn't really going out as strongly as it should about the safety of healthcare workers. And somehow it's not being as seriously evaluated. Do you feel that way as well?
I think there were a couple of important messages in the document that we include that we want to convey. I mean, I think the first is that, you know, we should encourage sick employees to stay home. And if they've got symptoms, cough, shortness of breath, or fever, they should be instructed not to report to work. And I think all of our labs need to have contingency plans to account for that potential absenteeism. I think that for patients and for the labs, the way you're scheduling patients will have to change so that there's adequate time to clean the equipment and for adequate time for scheduling intervals. And I think screening processes, in our institution, we have very strict screening protocols for patients before they come in the door, both in the outpatient setting and the inpatient setting, so that by the time they get to the scanner, they've ideally been screened, but you know, a second screening point can also be the point of the scan. And I think, you know, all those things are put into place to really try to put staff health first.
I think those are great points. And Kavita, your comments about protecting healthcare workers, I think, are just so important right now. And unfortunately, this is one of the real crises we have right now in this country and other countries, is that we just don't have enough personal protective equipment, PPE. There is a tremendous shortage, particularly of masks, as we all know. This is really one of those situations that our government really is behind and our industry is behind. And it is just so important for us to understand what are the resources we have and how do we use those to protect the healthcare workers, because we can't have healthcare without healthcare workers. And at this point, really, we should do everything possible. This is, of course, well beyond the cardiac CT community. This is a general comment, but everything possible to protect every single healthcare worker. I'm proud of my own institution and many others around the country who have now implemented these policies that PPE is required at all times. But I have real concern for ability to keep on doing that across the country as cases ramp up.
Yeah, exactly. And Andrew, what do you think, you know, in terms of, I just really love how this document is laid out and discusses the, you know, the optimal use of cardiac CT in various, you know, various scenarios. But I also feel like it will become the standard of care even after this pandemic is over. Do you feel that way in certain situations, like replacing TEE prior to cardioversion?
Yeah, Kavita, I think you bring up a really good point. I think for the listeners of the Pulse, there are two major areas that our writing group identified where CT may be preferred and perhaps just the superior approach to patients. The first is for those that are undergoing transesophageal echocardiography to rule out left atrial appendage thrombus prior to cardioversion. What we've learned from Milan and Seattle and other experiences is because the virus aerosolizes, TEE became a way where the virus could spread quickly. And I think at our institution, we have changed and we've stopped doing TEEs for this indication completely. And in general, we've really limited TEE to just the highest need indications. And in other cases, really seeking alternative approaches, which predominantly include cardiac CT. I think the second indication has been whether CT can decisively exclude coronary disease or high-risk anatomy, and in doing so, it can prevent inpatient admissions and resource use. And I think that parallels the already existing data around acute chest pain and coronary CT and decreasing downstream testing and decreasing resource utilization. I think that's an important way in this era where you really need to, for the safety of the patients, get your patients home as quickly as possible. And I think those two things are important points for us. And I think that it creates a starting point in an era of cardiovascular care and cardiovascular imaging in which we really need to evaluate all of the indications that for which we use cardiovascular imaging.
Absolutely. And Ron, what do you think about the issue of myocarditis and how cardiac CT can potentially help us, because it's a viral infection and myocarditis and elevated troponins become a reality for those of us on the consult service?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Kavita. There are, of course, many reports now of COVID-19 resulting in myocarditis, often presenting with ST elevations, elevated troponins, at times heart block as well. And then when these patients undergo invasive angiography, they have non-obstructive disease. And of course, the challenging question is, can you use CT? And the answer, of course, is yes, because CT can exclude obstructive coronary disease. But I think the more challenging question is, when should you use CT? Because doing a cardiac CT in an infected patient is, of course, a big deal in terms of exposure, in terms of cleaning the scanner. And I think we need to be selective in who we do a cardiac CT under those situations, as we have outlined in this document. So really, in my mind, this is something that we are going to be addressing in future iterations of this document. We only should reserve CT when we think it's going to result in a change in patient management. So in a case where myocarditis can be diagnosed clinically, perhaps a younger patient, elevated troponin, global LV dysfunction, I think in many cases like that, the diagnosis of myocarditis can be done on a clinical basis. Diffuse ST elevations, by the way, that are in all leads, perhaps PR segment elevations and AVR. So in cases like that, CT may not be necessarily needed. It's going to be more cases where there is a real question of whether the patient is having an acute coronary syndrome, specifically ST elevation or myocarditis, when it's really unclear, and based on the results of the CT, you would then decide if to go to the cath lab or not. So in those specific situations, I think CT can be very helpful. Because many of these patients may already have a chest CT, in those situations, I think it's always important to look at the chest CT, to look at the pattern of coronary calcifications. Of course, if it's extensive, CT may be more limited. If there's no coronary calcifications on a chest CT, you know the CT would be higher yield, but you also know that they're probably more likely to have myocarditis perhaps in some of those cases. So the bottom line is I do see an important need for CT here, but one that we will need to be selective upon.
And Ron brings up really important scenarios that I know many around the world are considering and incorporating. And you know, I think that we want to be dynamic and flexible in really incorporating best practices. I think some other considerations are that if you're considering scanning a COVID patient, which will hopefully be a very small amount of the time because the risk of exposure is going to be higher in most cases, that all of your staff and personnel that are involved have full PPE. And that's something that the SECT is advocating strongly for, having a patient, him or herself, wear a surgical mask. But another issue that comes up is just decontaminating the room between cases. At our institution, we've set up a dedicated separate CT scanner for any COVID patient, which is primarily for chest imaging, but it's also because it takes at least an hour and a half to decontaminate the room between the cleaning and the drying process, and then to change it over. And at least within the writing group, you know, the average is at least between 1 and 2 hours for decontamination. And so that means that there's a limited number of patients that can be scanned each day, which makes the patient selection even the more important.
Yeah. Kavita, one of the things I wanted to share with our listeners with respect to the document is, first of all, we wanted to make it very concise because nobody has the time to read long documents right now. But even beyond that, if you're going to look at one aspect of the document, to me, the crux where I encourage our listeners to look at that, it's table two. And this really our table, if I could just summarize a couple points for the listeners of really what table two is all about, is trying to isolate the cardiac CT indications that we think can be elective and deferred from those that are urgent. So I feel like if anyone really wants to kind of get a quick snap, that is the crux, of course, this document. Not only is it now online and in press on the journal on JCCT, but it's also on the SCCT website where anyone can access it.
So Ron, could you give us like a brief summary of the take-home points of this document?
Well, maybe I'll focus, since I just mentioned table two, I think I'll focus on some of those indications. I mentioned earlier, of course, that calcium scores can certainly be deferred and should be deferred. But beyond that, when we talk about coronary indications, patients that have stable chest pain, unless they have a very high suspicion of coronary disease and a potential need for imminent intervention, these are really cases that can be deferred. And I think we feel even more comfortable doing so now in light of the ischemia trial results. So fortunately, that those results came out before this pandemic. But on the other hand, patients who do have acute chest pain, some of them would benefit from a cardiac CT. But even in those cases, I think we have to be selective. Low-risk acute chest pain patients may not need any testing. I think we all know that. But those that have sufficient clinical suspicion, as we put it in the document, are the ones that we would think may benefit from a cardiac CT. And we, on purpose, defined it loosely defined. We define this loosely as sufficient clinical suspicion because there's no magic risk score, I think, that will tell you which acute chest pain patients are high enough that they really need to be tested right now. And this is something that clinicians will need to decide upon. Aside from coronary artery indications, of course, we use CT a lot these days for structural heart disease. But whenever that's done for a procedure that's going to be deferred, like TAVR or TMVR or closing a left atrial appendage, these are all cases that can be deferred if the procedure will be deferred. And I'll tell you, at least in my institution, these are procedures that certainly will be deferred until after things settle down a little bit. Plenty of other elective indications that we often do for cardiac CT, which we should not be doing at this time, like evaluating patients who have a stable cardiomyopathy, evaluating the severity of aortic stenosis, where we use cardiac CT, evaluating patients with cardiac masses that have a very high likelihood of being benign. So these are all cases that should be deferred. On the other hand, the cases that we think cardiac CT may be required sooner than later is if we are thinking of cardioverting a patient that has a possible clot, perhaps they have not been anticoagulated on a regular basis, as Andrew just mentioned to us. And sometimes patients that have acute valvular issues with a prosthetic heart valve dysfunction. So, of course, the table lists these in more detail, but this gives our listeners a flavor of some of the indications that we are discussing.
Yes, table two is absolutely fantastic. It's a great summary. And by the way, this document is available on open access on the JCCT website as well as on the SCCT website. Andrew, could you summarize this whole thing for us and tell us what the future directions are?
Yeah, thank you, Kavita. I think that what all of us recognize is that this pandemic is rapidly evolving, and the recommendations that are coming from the CDC and other associated global organizations also continue to change. And so our intent is that we provide with this is an initial step, an initial document, and the document itself will, I think, uniquely be a living document, one that will change to meet the needs of the cardiovascular CT community, and that we will be updating on a regular basis, probably on about an every other week, every 2 week basis, both online and in the journal. And so to look on those sources for those updates is to follow what's happening on social media on the SCCT account for updates. And I think that we will be all learning together what the best use and approach to cardiac CT is in this environment.
Yes, I think there will be a lot of updates coming up. So thank you both so very much for all that you do for all of us. I hope that you and all our listeners and everybody who's on the front lines will take good care and be safe. And I hope to talk with you both soon. Thank you for being here on JCCT Pulse.
Thank you very much, Kavita.
Thank you, Kavita, for having us, and please stay safe.
It is my absolute pleasure right now to invite Dr. Kelly Branch and Dr. Mahmoud Mossabasha of the University of Washington, as well as Dr. Gianluca Pantone of Centro Cardiologico Manzino in Milan, Italy. Welcome, everybody, to the JCCT Pulse. And thank you so much for being here on this special episode where we are going to discuss a cardiovascular imaging, particularly cardiovascular CT in the COVID-19 pandemic era. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Our pleasure.
Kelly and Mahmoud, you've seen a lot of these cases now in Washington. Could you kind of lead us into this conversation with an idea of what kinds of cases you're seeing that you end up imaging in with cardiac CT?
So in terms of imaging of these patients, there's multiple directions that we go in. One thing is in terms of baseline screening for COVID-19, imaging generally isn't within that algorithm. We rely on the PCR test to screen those patients. Imaging comes in when potentially alternative diagnoses are considered, whether cardiac etiologies or other diseases such as pulmonary embolism or other processes. And sometimes in that setting, the CT can help in terms of ruling in a viral pneumonia such as COVID-19. And so in those settings, sometimes it's helpful in terms of making the COVID-19 diagnosis or making alternative diagnoses. But these are cases where typically the COVID-19 PCR test is not considered until that CT is performed. In addition, in urgent imaging of symptomatic COVID-19 patients, that's another area where we're frequently doing imaging and have to take the precautions that are necessary for COVID-19. There is the concern that in the setting of, you know, a major surge of patients, the imaging would take a more frontline approach in the setting of COVID-19, where we wouldn't have the resources to perform the PCR tests in a timely manner and be able to triage the patients through the hospital, but rather would have to use imaging as a more rapid exam. The main limitation in terms of CT, while it is a relatively sensitive exam for COVID-19, it's relatively nonspecific because there is overlap with other viral pneumonias, such as influenza. But in the setting of limited resources, it could potentially be a valuable tool.
And are you using CT right now in certain cases, or has the throughput been in that rapid fashion where you've had to do that certain days?
So far, we haven't gotten to the point where we have a surge, a major surge where it overwhelms our other resources and we have to rely on CT imaging. Most of our COVID-19 patients are focused at one hospital, though now it is becoming distributed across all our hospitals a little more. But even at that hospital, we still have the resources to manage as of right now. But, you know, as this continues to ramp up, we are preparing for that potential surge and that need for imaging to serve on the front line.
I see. And Gianluca, how's it in Italy?
Okay. In Italy, of course, you have to consider that we are actually in an area where the prevalence is very high. It's the second prevalence in the world after China. And so we need to consider the diagnostic workup based on the prevalence that we have at the moment in our hospital. Usually, our strategy is mainly based to do a triage for all people who are coming to the hospital, including patients, of course, but also healthcare staff, before to come inside in the hospital. Our triage include, of course, symptom collection, fever, cough, dyspnea, and body temperature to all patients. And based on this pre-triage, we consider three different kind of category. Patients who are negative for everything, patients who have just fever but no additional symptoms, respiratory symptoms, or patient with respiratory symptoms. When I'm talking about respiratory symptoms, we check also oxygen saturation, and in case it is below 94%, we consider this as an objective sign of dyspnea. In the first category, negative patient or subject, they can have access to the hospital in a sort of clean route in which they do usual workflow for any kind of test. In case of a patient who has just fever with no symptoms, other additional symptoms, we refer the patient usually at home to just keep a quarantine for 2 weeks. And in case of worsening of symptoms, they can contact the hospital. On the contrary, in the last category with the respiratory symptom, usually these people are referred for further evaluation. And this further evaluation at the moment include an oropharyngeal swab and imaging. X-ray and CT is still under debate. To be honest, in our experience, we are using more CT, chest CT, than X-ray, despite this is not aligned with the position of the official society, because in our personal experience, CT is not specific, but absolutely more sensitive. And now we have the aim to identify the patient at the beginning of their history for two aims. First, to isolate them, and second, in case of a swab positive, to start with a therapy in an early stage.
Right. What kinds of, you know, cardiac complications are you all seeing in, you know, at your centers, you know?
Yes, it's clear. Actually, there are two considerations that we are observing. One is on thromboembolism, pulmonary embolism, and the second consideration comment is about the acute coronary syndrome. Regarding to the first point, we are observing an increase of this event in the setting of COVID-19 infection. And this was also reported by Chinese experience that showed the potential association between infection and the development of embolism. This is the first consideration. Regarding the second aspect, acute coronary syndrome, what we are observing at the moment, a reduction of the number of patients with acute coronary syndrome referred to our hospital. At the moment, we don't know if this is just related to the trend of people to stay at home because they are scared to go to the hospital or similar situation. And we will discover in the next days because we will discover patients with a late presentation. We don't have still data on that. And this is the first comment. The second comment is that among the patients with acute coronary syndrome who were referred to our hospital for this, in which we performed the cath lab, we observed a higher rate of a patient with no obstructive coronary artery disease. So a higher rate of myNOCA. Just a couple of numbers to have an idea. In this period of the year, we observed 27% of myNOCA as compared to the 4% in the same month of the last year. These are just preliminary data. We don't know if this data will be confirmed, but is a trend. And probably behind this number could be present a high number of myocarditis that we need still to confirm.
Yeah, that is actually mind-blowing. Nearly 30%. And Kelly and Mahmoud, what's your experience in Washington?
We're seeing something that's pretty close to what Gianluca is actually seeing as well. We are not seeing quite as much myNOCA, although we're definitely seeing a decrease in the number of patients that are presenting with kind of the standard cardiac complaints. We're not seeing as much, you know, AFib, ACS, those kinds of things. And I think people are just, you know, truly scared to come in. The emergency department looks a little bit like a ghost town sometimes, where it's all COVID-19 rule-outs, and that's about it. So I think people are kind of, you know, suffering at home a little bit. That being said, for the people that do come in, we're not seeing myocarditis necessarily. And I think that reflects what the Chinese are reporting, is that these early reports that there could be myocarditis may be inflated, may be more idiotypic rather than routine, and may not occur at all based on some of the postmortem data. But, you know, since these are older patients, these are the patients that are going to be high risk for cardiovascular complications. That includes PE and ACS. So it's kind of a infection supply-demand mismatch that occurs. And then those patients are the ones that look like it's, myocarditis, and it's just plain old down the road ACS.
Wow. Yeah. Like cardiac CT would make perfect sense in this scenario, right? Instead of exposing healthcare professionals in the cath lab, not that CT doesn't expose us to the disease, but we could avoid invasive procedures is the thinking. Is that what all of you think as well? Is this your experience that CT could be very useful?
Yeah, that's definitely been our experience. And we've created the SCCT has created a document around that Think You Know About It. And Jean-Luc and I are both co-authors on that. And it really was to feature that, you know, to use CT, whether or not you're ruling in or ruling out COVID is one issue. But in those patients that are coming in with, you know, chest pain is a symptom that can occur with these individuals. And CT seems like a very logical next step for those individuals.
If I can add one comment on that, you have to consider that in our region, we have created a sort of Spock Hub network in which there are some hospitals who are considered COVID hospitals. So they are all patients with COVID infection, and some hospitals, they are considered for hub to provide assistance in cardiology indication and so on. My hospital, for example, is the hub hospital for all cardiology cases of the region. So other hospital who has, for example, acute coronary syndrome, refer these patients to us in our hospital. What we are doing now? Of course, in ST elevation myocardial infarction, we refer the patient to the cath lab directly. We do the swab, but of course, we don't wait the result of swab to refer the patient to the cath lab. But in acute coronary syndrome and non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, and in case of a stable patient, we do the swab, but waiting for the result of a pharyngeal swab, we are doing cardiac CT in a new concept of a triple rule out. I mean, we do cardiac CT to rule out embolism, to check pneumonia, of course, and in case to rule out the presence of coronary artery disease due to the high prevalence of myNOCA. And in case the coronary artery disease is not present, there is no disease, we had a late acquisition to try to prove the presence of myocarditis, because this is very useful, because in case the CT is positive for myocarditis and the patient has a COVID-19 infection, to do a cardiac MR is very complicated for concern related to the cleaning of a scanner. So in this way, we can imagine a sort of CT, cardiac CT, for all the same in one acquisition. And in the period of COVID-19, could be very useful. We scan just preliminary experience in some patients, and it seems it works quite well.
Yeah. And what are the implications, you know, with all of this imaging, you know, in the SCCT document that you both co-authored, which we discussed at length with Andrew and Ron on this episode, there is quite a lot of emphasis on safety for technologists and healthcare workers in the area of cardiac imaging. What has been your experience in terms of the ease of doing that?
So in terms of the safety of our technologists and all the other workers, I think it's something we definitely emphasize, and it's something that requires a lot of communication between the ordering providers, whether it's cardiologists, whether it's the emergency department, or whether it's, you know, other inpatient clinical units, and our technologists and our frontline workers. I think that pre-knowledge that this is the case and you know, equipping the patient with a mask and preparing the technologist to deal with the patient in that regard is paramount. And generally, I think we do a pretty good job. Occasionally, we get cases where the patient is not a COVID rule out, or it's not clear as to whether the patient's a COVID rule out or not. And then at some point, they convert. And I think that creates some concern amongst our workers, the radiology workers. But we just try and get it as best as we can in most cases, just to make sure everyone is appropriately protected.
Right. And Gianluca, what's your experience?
Yes, in our hospital, considering the high number of patients, we have split our CT lab in two halves. There is one scanner dedicated for suspected or confirmed COVID-19 infection, and one scanner dedicated for clean route. I mean, patients who result negative in the screening for infection. In this way, we can use two different safety rules in the two settings. In the clean route, usually all people and also the patient use a surgical mask and gloves. This is the general protection that we have. In the scanner dedicated for suspected or confirmed COVID-19 infection, we, in addition to surgical mask, we use double gloves, and then we cover all healthcare staff with the waterproof coverage. And of course, we use also protection for hands. We use a mask with the filter, so higher level of protection, in case we have a patient in which aerosol is produced. For example, patient with invasive ventilation or similar procedure. Because in this case, we need to be more protected because the virus is also in the environment inside the room. What is important in general that we clean at the end of each exam the scanner in both settings. In the area dedicated for suspected or infected people, of course, but also in the area where we scan a patient who was not suspected. Because in an area with high prevalence, we cannot be sure, totally sure, to have a patient without infection if he has no symptoms. So for this reason, we are cleaning at the end of each exam. This impact on the workflow, because we needed at least 30 minutes at the end of each exam, but we consider this really important to limit the spread of infection.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. And how do you all think that, you know, these guidelines that you have co-authored, and it's such a great document. Thank you so much for doing that. Do you think that, you know, these guidelines and similar guidelines from other societies are really an indication of long-term change, even after this pandemic is over and we have discovered new ways of imaging, new ways of taking care of patients? Is that what you feel from your now extensive clinical experience in these hotspots?
I believe that the guidelines are very useful, but the main problem of these rules is that they are extremely prevalence correlated. What I mean? Now we are discussing rules because we are in a true pandemic phase in Lombardia, for in my region, for example. But of course, this kind of approach should be adapted in case next month the trend of infection will change. So we need to be extremely flexible to modify the rules on fly, because based on the trend, probably we need to adapt them.
And in terms of long-term changes, you know, beyond, you know, the scope of COVID-19 and a potential, you know, secondary surge maybe next fall that people are proposing, I do think this is going to have a lasting impact on the approach of physicians and healthcare workers. I mean, I think it's going to have an impact on society in general. I think the reliance on more virtual workflows and really building up those processes and building up telehealth processes will certainly become a larger reality for everyone. And I think a lot of groups and a lot of departments are working to bolster those processes. And on our side, you know, both on the healthcare side, but also in other areas, we have now virtual grand round speakers. Most of our meetings are virtual. And I think those are lasting changes that are going to stick. I mean, I think that's a move in a positive direction. I think the next time, you know, once we get through this COVID-19 process, the next time a healthcare crisis or pandemic like this strikes, I think we will probably be better prepared to manage it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the hope. Thank you. Thank you all so much. And thank you for all you do. And not just for the patients, but for us, the community, with, you know, your sharing of your knowledge in the form of this document and others. Thank you again for joining me on JCCT Pulse. And I hope that all of you will remain safe. And I hope we'll get to talk again soon.
Thank you very much, Kavita.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on JCCT Pulse. Please make sure you subscribe to the show so that you will never miss an episode. If you would like to read the articles we discussed today, they are available online along with the full issue at journalofcardiovascularct.com. And this link is provided in the show notes as well. SCCT members receive online access to JCCT as part of their membership. See you next time. Thank you for listening.